thinks about the failure to find WMD, but he maintains that the war was right. On torture, he says the gravity of the Abu Ghraib revelations came as a surprise to Bush, who had been kept out of the loop. He defends waterboarding as essential for America's safety. In fact, in the Times, the headline on the front page actually reads, "Waterboarding saved London from attacks," and he defends it quite vehemently, basically. Bush.
From whose attack, Tariq?
From whose attack indeed, yes, and of course he also says that British public opinion just doesn't matter.
Well, absolutely, because that was proven, wasn't it? During the, just before the Second Gulf War, 10 million people marched down Hyde Park just before the invasion of Iraq, and Blair just did not give a toss. We still went to war with Iraq, whether we liked it or not.
I mean, he actually compares Blair to the late Winston Churchill. Very interesting comparison indeed. And there's a number.
To be honest with you, I don't think Blair's nothing like the late Winston Churchill.
Winston Churchill was something else.
Absolutely.
I mean, he went to war because he had to go to war from an invasion from a Nazi regime. That's right. So he had no choice. But what Blair did was basically not listen to his people, the British people.
It was criminal what Blair did. It was a war that was illegal.
That's right.
It was a war not for weapons of mass destruction. It was to change Saddam's regime, and it was mostly for oil.
Hi, guys. Can I come in at this point?
Yeah, absolutely. Welcome,
I'd like to say something about this comparison between Blair and Churchill. I think, it's patently absurd that you can compare someone who had the moral courage to do what no one else in the world at the time did, prepared to do, which was to defend the Polish people against the invasion of the Nazi stormtroopers, and to stick to his principles about, look, there is such a thing as the nation states and nation sovereignty and international law, and we're not going to have any power, any particular power, violating sovereignty willy-nilly. And that was actually quite a courageous thing that Winston Churchill did, to stand up for moral principles at that point. And of course there were many people being slaughtered by the Nazis at the time, and it was an abhorrent regime. So I mean, you know, the British Empire has been pretty awful in its day, but there was really, I don't think, anything almost in history to compare to the absolute onslaught and the ideological racism of the Nazis at the time. And I think, you know, what Churchill did was quite possibly right. Even though I'm a pacifist, I would say in certain situations, you know, you do have to draw the line. But what Blair did was something entirely different, going against all international treaties which had been signed and sealed after the Second World War, after the horrors of the Second World War, and decided that it was okay to invade a sovereign country. And while many of us would disagree with Saddam Hussein, I think we would probably agree that there are many other regimes around the world who were actually treating their people worse than Saddam was. He certainly wasn't harbouring Al-Qaeda, which is one of the ostensible reasons for invading the country. And it has also turned out since that the reasons which were given by MI6, by John Scarlett, and the intelligence people, and by the Downing Street spin doctor, Alistair Campbell, were actually fraudulent lies. And so the war was a lie, and so what Mr. Blair was doing at the time was totally the opposite, really, of what Churchill was doing. He was actually turning Britain almost into the evil empire by making this ridiculous, abhorrent invasion. And now I think we've seen something like 1.5 million killed and displaced people in Iraq, possibly even more than that since. So Blair absolutely is a war criminal in my eyes, and I think we'd be very, very good to see him arrested. And of course that is what this ridiculous series of statements we've heard today from George W. Bush, justifying torture and all these other stuff to do with Tony Blair and terror attacks in Britain, is to try and shift the debate away from the crucial issue of how will it be that Mr. Blair gets arrested and goes to trial, and to shift it towards the debate, should Tony Blair be arrested, right? I think that's actually what's going on here. It's about trying to control the debate that's going on in the public sphere about Blair. And it's shifting it away from looking at him as a war criminal and how does he get brought to justice for his crimes. And in this book by Bush is just another way of getting everybody to be talking about, oh, well, should Blair, is Blair a war criminal or not? Well, of course, certainly on all the benefits of evidence, he certainly is. And so there is definitely a prima facie case for him to be arrested and tried for war crimes.
Well, even by his own admission, Tony, wasn't it, during the hot inquiry, if I'm correct, that he actually admitted that the war, the reason they went to war with Iraq is not because of weapons of mass destruction, it was to change the regime, and if I'm again correct, it's against the, like you say, all treaties, and like they say, even the Geneva Convention.
Well, there's this horrendous thing called the Downing Street Memo, which of course was, if you put that into any of the major national newspaper or BBC websites, you'll see all about that. That was a memo which was supposed to be kept secret, which was leaked, I imagine, by some civil servant who thought, look, this is potentially criminal activity, so I'm going to make sure it gets leaked, which proved that Tony Blair had actually made a promise to George Bush that he was going to go along with the war, come what may. So that, I'm afraid, is an extrajudicial process. He's not actually following legal advice when he's sitting over in a cosy little chat with George W. Bush. And let's not forget, in the context of all this, that the Bush family fortune was made during the Second World War from getting oil through to the Nazis, making money from basically running trading with the enemy. This is what was going on with the Bush, what's his name, Prescott Bush, which was George W. Bush's granddad. He was actually making fantastic amounts of money during the Second World War, whilst America was involved in the war and beforehand, making sure that Hitler got vital oil supplies through Switzerland. I mean, there's a whole load of stuff to do with the Bush family, but it's certainly absolutely clear that, that the Bush family fortune was made through collaboration with the Nazis during the Second World War, whilst the US was at war with Germany. So the man's a traitor to his own country and, of course, to ours, and a collaborator with the Nazis. Obviously George W. Bush didn't do that. His granddad did, but his family fortune was made on it. In the intervening years, it's come out that there were a lot of people in the U.S. intelligence community, as they like to call themselves, including the Dulles brothers and the not-so-well-known Dulles sister, and John Loftus writes about this in a lot of his books about the connections between the U.S. and the Nazis, where actually there was very, very strong cooperation between certain elements within the U.S. Government, particularly after the Second World War, helping Nazis to escape. So look, just a minute, Mr. Bush. I think your record is rather tainted here, and it does frustrate me that a lot of this stuff, which is actually very, very well documented, doesn't come out when we see George Bush's face on our TV screens, chatting blithely about how it's okay to bring people to the verge of death by drowning in order to get them to sign confessions. He was talking about Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, of course, who several hundred times was waterboarded. It seems that somebody somewhere in the U.S. Administration decided that any fantasy that they could dream up, they would just type it up, and then they'd go down, waterboard Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and he would sign that, and then they could then say, oh, well, look how dangerous Al-Qaeda is. They were planning this plot here, because we've got another statement from Khalid Sheikh Mohammed under torture that justifies what we're saying. And I thought it was also very interesting that today the Foreign Office refused to comment on any of these allegations that were made by George Bush about him having helped in these two plots at Canary Wharf, so-called plots anyway, at Canary Wharf and at Heathrow. The British government would had absolutely nothing to say about this, saying basically we refuse to corroborate what Bush is saying in these. And I think, you know, we're basically dealing with a very desperate regime, a very desperate man who is prepared to lie if necessary in order to convince people that he has somehow helped Britain. They're trying to desperately cement up a fragmenting relationship across the Atlantic by trying to get at least a few gullible people to believe that the US is torturing people to help Britain. Now, I just think that's ridiculous, and most, I would imagine, in British diplomatic circles around the world raise their eyes to the ceiling when they see George Bush coming out with ridiculous comments like this.
Well, there were a few, actually, if you like, rebuttals from certain people, I think MI6 and other people as well, where they said that that, quite frankly, torture is abhorrent, and it's not a method that should be used anyway at all. However, they did kind of backtrack on that a little bit as well, about, you know, the importance of the vitality of information and how it is a necessity to get that information. So it seemed as if, that in a way, they were sitting on the fence.
But the trouble is with this whole torture business is that all you need is somebody generating fictitious plots somewhere and typing them up onto bits of paper, sending them to a jail, and there's always some horrendous torturer somewhere, it seems, who will torture somebody, get them to sign the bottom of the bit of paper, and off you go with the next terror scare. Yeah, this is really rather worrying to think that what is actually very important to get right, information that's very important to get right, could actually be based, for the large part, on incredibly flimsy evidence.
If I could jump in, Tony, Bush has come out with his statements. How do you think the British public should react to this? I mean, he said he saved a lot of British people's lives through waterboarding and stopping the London bombings, or could have happened. How should the British people react? I mean, personally, I'm a bit sceptical. I mean, this is George Bush we're talking about here.
With the derision that these comments deserve, and I think most British people will. I mean, there aren't a lot of people in this country that have got a lot of time for George Bush, since a lot of stuff has come out about how his regime, first of all, was connected with the criminal gangs that were involved in drug running, particularly through the Iran-Contra scandal, which you might remember about 15 years or so ago. And, of course, George Bush's father, who was also president, I mean, it's rather scary, you know, getting into these dynastic politics. I'm going to pass down the White House to my son. You know, it starts to look like almost like a sort of an old-fashioned monarchy system.
A bit of nepotism.
Yeah. that many people in Britain are very sceptical about any kind of any words that come out of the White House at all, I'm afraid, particularly since their country is teetering on the brink of economic collapse and becoming a has-been nation, I suppose, in a way, a little bit like the old British Empire. I mean, Britain was respected around the world as a very powerful nation, actually feared, probably, and hated by many, too. But we certainly were a world superpower with the Empire, and then America kind of took on that mantle after the Second World War, and it can now see its empire crumbling, not only in its economic power and its industrial and military power, although the military power, of course, is being extended, but there is no real respect for the US anymore around the world, even though they had a very good public image, in that it was seen as a very wealthy country, a country where there was an incredible amount of opportunity. Now it's sliding down the scale, and I mean, this is the sort of almost like the fall of Rome we're watching here, as the leaders try more and more desperate measures to hold their public image together.
I think Tariq pointed out, George Bush pointed out, he had like a little plan to invade Iran as well, is that right? What do you
think? That was in the Guardian, front page of the Guardian, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how to talk.
Well, you probably remember the Arab League met in back in 2003. You were talking about that massive demonstration in London, the biggest demonstration ever taken place in Britain. We from Bristol, basically, I mean, I can remember at the time, the organisers from the Stop the War group here in Bristol were telling us that they'd actually found that even though they had sold tickets, they couldn't actually find any more coaches in the entire city to send people to London that weekend. We'd run out of coaches, and the demonstration proved, I think, beyond any shadow of a doubt, the strength of feeling in the country, and yet, of course, they went ahead with the invasion regardless, which is, you know, really absolutely abhorrent. But the Arab League at the time, back in 2003, I can remember this very well, because I saw a headline change on my computer. One of those things that you think, you look at a headline, there was a headline on the BBC website, and it was up there for about 10-15 minutes, obviously some journalists had published it themselves, and it actually said, war with Iraq could open the gates of hell, and this was a quote from the Arab League, and that was the headline, war could open the gates of hell. After about 15 minutes, the headline had changed, something more innocuous, like, could cause a lot of death, something like that, though. Obviously, opening the gates of hell was not thought to be an appropriate headline by the BBC editors, but one of the journalists obviously thought it was. And this was actually what the Arab League was saying back in 2003, that if the West allows this war to go ahead, the gates of hell will be opened in the Middle East. And of course, that's what we've seen. And we're seeing now in Iraq, week after week, even more, it seems, attacks, bomb attacks, innocent people being killed. This sort of thing wasn't going on in Saddam's time. So I think what we can say is we've been successful in nothing in Iraq.
I think.
And you could even say that what's happened there is this horrible image that we have of US, the threat that the Americans make to nations that they want to intimidate, like the sort of nasty gangster from down the street, is that they have been bombed back into the Stone Age. Much of the infrastructure that's been built up over centuries and decades has been destroyed, and that, that the infrastructure that ordinary families and people need to live is being destroyed daily, that people are walking around in the street in constant state of fear as to whether a bomb is going to go off next to them or not. And this is not a civilized country anymore. What's happened is the US-led attack on Iraq has actually really, really has bombed the people back to the Stone Age. But I have got a funny feeling about Iraq in that the people are incredibly resilient, and that their spirit will not be broken by this, and that in a way this has driven them more and more powerfully to their faith and to their families, and also to the understanding of the kind of evil forces which are ranged against.
That's pretty interesting. You mentioned the attacks. George Bush claims the British opinion doesn't matter. I mean, I think it clearly does show that. I mean, we marched, well, a number of us marched against it. Is there some element of truth in there?
Well, I mean, I think British opinion does matter. I think public opinion does matter. I'm a Democrat. And I think anybody that's a Democrat, I mean, I know he's a Republican, but anyone that believes in democracy does listen to public opinion. I mean, democracy is not actually a system, really. It's not, you know, what kind of voting system you use. It's a principle, and it's based on the Greek, which actually just means the people rule. So that is to say the government is there to serve the people. Now, if George Bush is saying that the public opinion doesn't matter, whether in the US or here, what he's actually saying is that he's a dictator. He's not a Democrat, he's a dictator. So in a way, he's kind of giving himself away there. And anyway, I find it incredible that a man with such a low integrity, a low intellect, with very little respect for the man, could ever make it to the office of president. It just, you know, shows how the democratic system can be dragged through the mud by people like this, and how some people's lust for power can have such terrible consequences. I don't know where all this is heading, but certainly it looks like there may be the audacity in the, particularly within the Israeli extremists and the military and the right-wing government there, Benjamin Netanyahu, and with a sort of a revitalized Republican side, if they are the hawkish Republicans rather than the more reasonable, inward-looking US-style, let's reform America Republicans, that it's possible that there may be an attack on Iran. So, and it may be that actually these recent elections have made that more likely. I mean, we did have a chat about this briefly last week, about the strategic importance of Yemen. So whenever I hear the word Yemen coming up on the radio, I'm immediately thinking, right, that's where you want your next military bases. Mm. I'm afraid that's how it's become, I'm afraid, that we've moved so far away from democracy that I think the military and the hawks who are looking to grab resources around the world to prop up their ailing economies seem to be in the driving seat.
And there's no chance of a reversal here that you can see in the near future.
I don't know. Look, I think there's always a chance of a reversal, because I think the establishment in America and here in Britain is quite a complex thing. And there are all sorts of elements within that establishment that are pressing one way or the other. The military, for example, here in Britain are very much their own people. They don't just simply do what the Americans want them to do. Also, they have very little respect for American military prowess and for their military ability. So you've got different factions here in Britain, and you've got different factions in the States. You've got some very good people in the military in America who recognize the desperate mistakes that have been made since the beginning of the launching of the War on Terror. There are people in the US military right now, and retired and veterans, people who do not believe the official version of events on September 11th story. I mean, we've seen, for example, the head of the U.S. Army War College, the former head of the U.S. Army War College, chief, the guy who's actually in charge of training all the officers, saying that he believes that the Israelis actually carried out the 9/11 attack. Now, this is pretty shocking stuff. So what it tells us is that there are all sorts of different blends of opinion within the military and within the establishment, even in the U.S. I mean, certainly there are here, but even in the U.S. So nothing is going to be simple in the years to come. I think it also may mean that if another war is launched, there may be some sort of military backlash, possibly even a military coup.
Okay, cool. George Bush, in his interview, he said he feels he shouldn't say sorry to anything. He felt 100% right what he did. He genuinely believed there were weapons of mass destruction. Whereas Blair,
he admits there was no weapons of mass destruction, but he feels that the war itself, despite the loss, despite the life loss, despite the destruction, was overall the just cause.
Yeah, I mean, Blair said he initially wanted to go for a regime change. I mean, there's a big contradiction there, where I can see.
Yeah, but all this, you see, is just diverting us away from the real issue, which is, when is Bush going to be arrested? Where is Bush going to be arrested? When is Blair going to be arrested? And where is Blair going to be arrested?
The thing is that after the incident in Canada, where somebody tried to carry out a citizen's arrest on Bush, and the police stopped them, basically, that person was incarcerated, and they're still unable to pay their bail money, basically. They're still stuck in debt as a result of trying to carry out a citizen's arrest on Bush. Many feel that that's given a level of impunity now to the rights.
Of course it hasn't. That's only one person. Imagine if 20 people did it. You know, there are actually plenty of people out there who would be prepared, I mean, in the anti-war movements around the Western world and other parts of the world too, plenty of people out there who would be prepared to put their liberty at risk to see justice done in these situations. And let's not forget, these are very serious international treaties that have been signed up to. And we've seen, I don't know if you noticed last week, there was another one of these issues with between Britain and Israel over the difficulty that some Israeli war criminals in the Israeli government have in coming to Britain now, because they're war criminals. And because of the fact that that they may be subject to arrest if they once they arrive at Heathrow Airport, they now won't come. So let's just, for a minute, start thinking about the rule of law. Unless we want to move into a lawless world where the rich and powerful actually are above the law, I don't think that there's many people, even within the establishment, that would like to see that.
So, absolutely.
You know, if this person has been arrested in Canada, as you say, that's just one incident. How many of those does it take before the policeman actually says, yes, you're right, and arrests Mr. Bush?
Indeed, and on that note, I'll just mention that we're coming up to a break very, very shortly, so we'll carry on with this after the break. You're listening to Unity FM 93.5, Heart of the City. Please do keep listening, and we'll be back after a short break.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. It's just after 9:30, Tuesday evening, November the 9th, 2010.
A bit of tongue twister at 9:11:10.
It is 9:11:10, yes. So all over the place, isn't it? Well, no, it's rather funny, actually. I mean, this year's flown past, and soon we'll be talking about 2011 and so forth. Anyway, you're listening to Behind the Headlines on 93.5 Unity FM. 0121-772-8892. You've got half an hour of the show left. Also, joining us is Mr. Gosling, regular member of the show, myself, obviously, and Tariq Ziad. Welcome to all of you. And Humayun.
Hello.
Do we still have Tony?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Fantastic,
still here.
Fantastic. Well, I mean, interesting, last half hour we've been talking about
George Bush's memoirs. I think perhaps to move on now, perhaps the next subject could be the 7/7 inquest, the ongoing the inquiry, and how it's
developing.
Actually, the interesting thing now, of course, is that apparently somebody has said that they were next to the bomber.
Yes, that's right. I heard this today. Now, let's not forget that this chap was very, very traumatised. And, you know, I think if this was a proper public inquiry, there may be questions over whether you know, somebody who is right next to an explosion like that, and is obviously going to be concussed, very, very badly injured, has actually got full recollection of the events. Now, this is one of the first we've seen. I mean, we've also had his testimony several times before, of an actual eyewitness. But let me tell you, I've spoken to another eyewitness, who's Daniel Obicheki, who was a tall West Indian guy who was on the bus, and he explained to me how it was newspaper people that came to him immediately after the bombings happened and showed him pictures of what they thought were the bombers, saying, "Did you see this man? Did you see this man? Did you see him do this? Did you see that?" And when he said no, that was it. There was no reporting of his story, etc. So, I mean, I think it's ever so difficult to know, but I think it is possible that this guy, I'm afraid I can't recall his name, who was giving testimony today.
And neither can I, as a present time.
He was, you know, it may be that he was, that the people who were interviewing, the police that were interviewing him, were suggesting stuff to him. At a point where he wasn't actually able to recall it. So we really don't know what happened, but it's ever so difficult to make these assertions coming from someone who... I mean, for example, there is contradictory evidence. Another person who was on another one of the underground trains said he didn't see any bomber or in the place where the bomb was supposed to be, and he also said that he saw that the floor had been ripped and torn upwards, as if the bombs were underneath the trains. We also heard from Mark Honingsby, the Guardian journalist, who was speaking to people directly as they were coming out, who did an audio report for the Guardian website, actually immediately after the bombings on 7th of July 2005, saying twice that the people who were coming out from the tube station were telling him that the bombs were underneath the train. So the story does seem to have changed. We've also heard this week the opening of a public inquiry into the failings at Staffordshire hospitals, several hospitals in Staffordshire. Now, if we can have a public inquiry for that, why can't we have a public inquiry for the 7th of July London bombings? And I'll tell you why I think we can't have a public inquiry for those, and that is that actually it would be able to properly subpoena witnesses, for example, from the police, from the security services, from the anti-terrorist branch, particularly people who had direct control and charge of at least what is believed to have been a terror exercise that was going on the morning of the 7th of July. All that would come out, and I'm afraid the fact that this inquest, although we're having one inquest for 52 separate deaths, which is just a very bizarre thing legally. I think if you talk to any lawyers, they'll be scratching your heads and saying, "Well, hang on, an inquest is individual single death, not for multiple deaths." Public inquiry is what you do when you have multiple deaths, and I think, you know, this to me flags up that there's something wrong here. Why is the legal proceeding going down this road of an inquest with no jury? And this is the underlining no jury. This is just simply Lady Justice Hallett, the coroner, who's going to be making all the decisions about what judgments are going to be made about this. And I'm afraid it's just like back in the case of Lady Diana. Looks to me like a cover-up.
I couldn't agree more.
Just briefly, you've mentioned on your show on Bristol City FM a blog that people can go to about 7/7.
I don't know if your listeners know, but there's an extremely good campaign that's been running almost since the immediate days after the July 7th attack. It's called J7, and it's the July 7th Truth Campaign. They have a very extensive research website, and they have been calling for a public inquiry right from the word go. They're now also working with the survivors, because many of the survivors have been shut out of this inquest process, although they're allowed to go along and watch the inquest. They're not able to ask questions, and the survivors are some of the people that have been most rawly treated by this entire process, and some of them are very angry. Some of them are very placid, they're very understanding. They will hold up their hands and say, "Well, look, I can't go back to being the same person as I was before those events. I'm just going to forget about it and go away." But there are others who are being very, very tenacious and continuing to ask questions. about the intelligence failings. And let's compare the situation with the 7th of July attacks to the situation with Staffordshire Hospital. What you've got is a systematic set of failings amongst officials. You have exactly the same under the 7th of July London bombings. The officials, the security service people, MI5 particularly, and also special branch at Metropolitan Police, anti-terrorist branch, failed dismally to follow these guys, even though, of course, that they had actually been photographing and following some of the bombers beforehand. They failed to detect a bomb plot. So you there have quite a serious failure. And in order for us to have confidence that the money, our taxpayers' money that goes every year into intelligence and security in this country, we need to learn the lessons from the 7th of July. Otherwise, this kind of thing is quite likely to happen again.
Indeed, and I think on this point, for us to move on and about any other bits of news that have caught your eye this last few days?
Well, there's all sorts of stuff, isn't there? I mean, we've also had, at the end of last week, a couple of days after I spoke to you last,
yes,
there was a bunch of arrests in Iran, which rather caught my attention. It was a kind of embarrassing blip on the news. It came on a few bulletins and then it disappeared.
I've heard nothing.
In Iran, Majid Bakitar, Hajir Ebrahimi, Lokman Moradi and Zanyar Moradi, they are members of the banned Kormala group, and they were arrested in Iran's western city of Marivan, and that was reported by Press TV. Now, the trouble is that these guys, these four Kurds, have been working with and for a UK-based leader, and this is what's irritating the Iranian government. Now, these four terrorists, this is what the Iranians are calling them, are responsible for assassinating five people in Iran, and yet they're working for someone over here in Britain, we're told by the Iranian press. He's a British-based terrorist, they call terrorist anyway, named Jalil Fatani, and he's been leading the terror group actually from Sulaymaniyah in Iraq. So Britain is actually very connected to these people, and it was rather embarrassing, you know, I think, to hear this on the radio. Oh, well, maybe the British are actually sanctioning terrorism in Iran. Now, this is a very dangerous state of affairs when people are being accused left, right and centre of being a terrorist in other people's countries. Then what you've got is the seeds of the sorts of incidents that could spark war. And, of course, as we all remember, the fascinating incident of the British naval personnel who were arrested by the Iranians and then subsequently released after being actually very well treated in Iran. That sort of incident was blown up in the press here out of all proportion. And, of course, Craig Murray, who's one of really the world's greatest bloggers, I would say, he's somewhere a whistleblower from the Foreign Office who writes a blog quite regularly, happened to be the Foreign Office expert on maritime law, and he was able to explain, well, actually, sorry guys, but the Navy shouldn't have been there, and that the Iranians were perfectly within their rights to arrest these British naval personnel. And, you know, so it does show that small things like this can spark big incidents. And let's face it, this is what MI6 does. It doesn't have, you know, loads of good-looking James Bonds wandering around the world in flashy cars and with lovely girls. You know, that's actually not the way it works. It's much more that what MI6 does, the Foreign Intelligence Service, as opposed to MI5, which is the Domestic Intelligence Service, what they do is they run spies in foreign countries, and of course the most perfect spy to run is not a flashy, white, tall, good-looking James Bond. It is actually someone who is a local person who looks very much like local people, as of course the Kurds do. And what I think is happening here is MI6 are very cynically exploiting the Kurdish problem. And if we can remember back to the first Gulf War, back in the early 90s, you know, there was loads of complaining about the way Saddam had treated the Kurds over the years. Now we are actually, the West is now in full control, supposedly, of Iraq, even though they've handed over to a sort of puppet government. There is absolutely no reason why a Kurdish homeland can't be now created in the northeast of Iraq. with a bit of negotiation with the Turks. It would be lovely to give the Kurds a homeland. Absolutely brilliant. And so what's happened is they blocked that homeland, and what's happening, I think, anyway, is that MI6 are now using the Kurdish will to have their own country, which they should have by right, really, under lots of the discussions that have been had at the United Nations. They're now exploiting the grievances of the Kurds and actually recruiting from the Kurds to infiltrate and to attack Iran, seeing Iran as the bogeyman in all this. And of course, this is just a way of influencing political affairs in a country like Iran, helping to destabilize Iran by looking around all over the surrounding district for anybody who's got a grudge with the Iranians, and then funding them, helping them, patting them on the back, and giving them all the tools that they need to cause trouble for Tehran. And that, it looks like, is what's happened in this situation. So we didn't get a lot of analysis of that story, and that's probably why, because it's rather embarrassing that our taxpayers' money is going to fund terrorism in Iran. Just as Annie Mashorn and David Shaler showed back in the 90s that our taxpayers' money was going to fund terrorism in Libya and to actually fund an assassination attempt by MI6 on the Libyan leader, Colonel Gaddafi.
It's incredible when you think about it, it really is.
Well, it's because of the lack of accountability. I think that's the problem. We've got a kind of a weak media. We've got a very weak accountability structure through the Intelligence and Security Committee and the Joint Intelligence Committee, which are either stuffed full of people who are ex-military and friends with the military. There doesn't seem to be proper oversight of the intelligence people. And even when a whistleblower comes out of the woodwork, as Richard Tomlinson did back in the 1990s, I don't know if you've ever come across him, have you?
Sorry?
Richard Tomlinson was an ex-MI6 agent.
Yes, I have heard that name.
He wrote a fantastic book, which I would recommend everybody in Birmingham read. It was really actually a rip-roaring read. It was rather like the Spycatcher book. It couldn't be published here in Britain because it breached the Official Secrets Act, but it was published in Moscow. The book's called The Big Breach by Richard Tomlinson. And what he was saying there was that he was witnessing all sorts of really dodgy stuff going on in MI6. And, of course, what he'd do is he would report to his manager, hang on, someone here is doing something criminal, doing something illegal. And their way of dealing with his internal complaints was to attempt to have him assassinated. So what they did is they sent him into a situation where his cover was blown, but he was supposed to be an agent. But luckily, he managed to talk his way out of it and managed to survive. I think he's basically a decent guy. And this was during the Bosnian conflict.
Mm.
Then he survived to write his book, and he can't come back to Britain because he would be arrested when he came in at the airport or in at the docks under the Official Secrets Act. So he has to now live in the south of France somewhere. I think he's still down in the south of France, as far as I know. But his book is definitely available and well worth a read. So you can see the kind of stuff that goes on at MI6 is there's virtually no scrutiny of it whatsoever. And some would say that's the best way to do it. You just trust these intelligence people to get on with it. But as we've seen with all the carnage that's come out of the horrific Iraq situation and what I have to really call an evil attack on a virtually defenseless country against the sort of might that was thrown against it by Britain and America, we have to be very, very worried about, I think, institutions like MI6 throwing their weight around the world and, let's face it, conducting criminal acts and criminal activity and funding terrorism. And if they can fund terrorism in Iran without getting very much criticism from the British press, and no credibility really is given to the Iranian side of the story, which is saying, well, we're arresting these people because they're assassins, run by a guy who's got very strong British connections, then, you know, it does make you wonder about the media's role in all this, that something so obvious could be just kind of, you know, forgotten about and not really looked into properly. This is a serious problem we've got in Britain, is we've got this thing called the permanent government. MI6 mm-hmm. don't have to be up for re-election every 4 or 5 years. They are in there pretty much permanently, on permanent contracts, and if anyone tries to get rid of them, then they can pay some of the best lawyers in the country to make sure they stay in their job. That's if anyone dares to try and get rid of them.
That seems rather draconian.
We've got a parasitic state, permanent government, in certain parts of government, which are really, you know, what they're doing is they're doing a lot of operations abroad. There was a very, very good case, let's not forget, for actually cutting them as part of this comprehensive spending review. But I don't know if you noticed in the weeks running up to the comprehensive spending review in October, but there were loads and loads of terror scare stories.
Yes, I did notice,
to justify their existence.
Yes.
I would like to see a thorough, what you'd have to call a royal commission, really, investigating the intelligence services, because there's so many incidents now of whistleblowers being sidelined, potentially killed. I mean, we had this weird incident of the guy whose body was found in a holdall. Could it be that he knew something about his own intelligence services? I mean, they've been trying to paint it as an incident where possibly a foreign government has killed him. I think it's at least as likely, if not more likely, that he knew something about some activities of the British intelligence services, MI6 or GCHQ, but most likely MI6, because they conduct these black operations, that he knew something that he shouldn't know. Or that he was possibly even threatening or talking to a journalist or potentially going to be blowing the whistle on something, and that he was just simply assassinated by, in inverted commas, his own side. These people really do need to be thoroughly investigated, and it often you often find that when journalists and others do try and investigate them, that they end up not necessarily dead, but they end up being intimidated away from the story. So there's a lot of intimidation goes on by these people. I think it's probably fair to say that MI5 aren't quite so bad. It's very difficult to know these things, but their job is more of the simple job, really, and it's much more generally within the law, because the British law has jurisdiction here in Britain. But the trouble with MI6 is they're used to being given this kind of license to kill, where they go out into a foreign country, but under British orders. So they're either intelligence gathering or they are disrupting a country which is not friendly to Britain. I'm talking about places. I mean, you should probably know the sorts of places I mean. I mean, Iran at the moment, and places like Zimbabwe, which are the hated countries of the Foreign Office. So you often see the same sort of thing talked about these various countries. Whereas I think there's actually far, you know, there are positive things to say about, for example, the Guardian last week had a fantastic article about the Zimbabwe's land reform program and some of the positive signs of it. Because let's not forget, for literally decades and decades, the land in Zimbabwe was actually, you know, this is very galling for the native population, but the land was controlled by white farmers. Imagine,
yes,
it was your land, and a whole bunch of bullies came along, white bullies came along, kicked you off your land, so you couldn't actually grow any food, and then said, oh, it's okay, you can come and work for us for next to nothing.
And this is why, Tony, they were very quick to show the images of farmers being chased away a few years ago, but didn't quite show the full story. In fact, I've spoken to somebody from a neighbouring country to Zimbabwe, and he spoke about how Mark Thatcher came there, I believe back in the 90s, to monopolise tobacco and many other resources in places like Zimbabwe, South Africa, Zambia, and the neighbouring countries. And of course, it all actually dates back to Cecil Rhodes, of course, and Rhodesia, and the early colonising by the British Empire of the African nations back then. The monopolising of diamonds. It has got a very, very long history people don't know about.
Well, let's not forget also that there is a virtually fascist regime in Colombia. I mean, they are basically, the country is run by the big corporations, companies like the big sugar companies, that kind of thing. And it was only up until a few years ago, under the Labour government, that the policy was changed. But actually, British troops were over there training the paramilitaries and the Colombian army, who were then going and murdering people in the countryside, basically anybody that stood up to these drug cartels who were closely linked to some of the big corporations in Colombia, and Britain was actually aiding that process. And I think it's very good that we've now stopped that, although of course it's possible that we've got British mercenary companies being employed by these sugar companies now, and I think this is an increasing problem. I think many serving military people or retired military people and people in the British Legion, etc., would agree with me when I say one of the biggest potential problems is the ability of fantastic amounts of money that some of these, of these bailed out banks have and their friends, to simply employ mercenaries to go and do dirty work, that is private armies, to go and look after the interests of the banks and the corporations. And of course, that's what we've seen in Iraq, as the official military has been being pulled out. So the people that have been going in there to...
The likes of Blackwater, etc.
...are private military companies and mercenaries. And this is where we start to get into the realms of the really scary and surreal, where it's actually all about money. And whether someone lives or someone dies just depends on whether they end up on the end of a mercenary's bullet. You know, it starts to be pretty scary. And of course, in a country like Iraq right now, which is really suffering because of having a lack of government for so many months, they haven't actually come to an agreement about who is going to be the government, is the judiciary starts to suffer, and what happens there is it starts to become the law of the jungle, and we get really back full circle to what we were talking about at the beginning of the program about the horrors of Iraq being actually essentially bombed back to the Stone Age. So their system of justice is just another casualty, just like their water system, their electricity system, and all their basic infrastructure.
It really is. It's terrible. We are now, of course, going to the closing minutes of the show. Unfortunately, I think we need another hour. We'd like to ask at this point, what's going to be on the Drive Time show on BCFM this week?
I'm not really quite sure. One thing I can tell you is definitely going to be on is I've got a couple of interviews with John Loftus. Now, I don't know if you've come across him, but he's an author we spoke about briefly. He's an author that looks at the connections between the U.S. administration. I mean, not the whole U.S. administration, but particular individuals since the Second World War and the Nazis. And he's absolutely clear that some of the key people being involved in some of the massive drug dealing, drug cartels, use of military equipment to move drugs around the world in the US, and laundering of Nazi gold, laundering of Nazi money after the Second World War, propelling it back into some of the corporations which survived the war, back into Germany, doing a kind of a loop through Argentina up to New York and then back to Berlin again. So we'll be having a little chat with John Loftus, who I find is fascinating. The other thing about John, which I don't know if we'll have time to touch on Friday, is that he is the only person, as far as I know, to point out the key role of this chap, Haroun Aswat, from Dewsbury, in the 7/7 London bombings. Now, there are all sorts of things connecting Haroun Aswat to these four alleged bombers on the 7th of July, John Loftus was the guy who actually pointed it out. Now, hang on a minute, this guy looks like, by the behaviour of him, he was working for MI6, so we're back to MI6 again. Mm. Now, what Haroun Aswat was doing was he disappeared just literally at the same time as the London bombings out of Britain, rather suspiciously, but he was one of the prime suspects. He was arrested in several countries and then immediately released. What does that tell you about the ability of the intelligence services to potentially to phone up foreign embassies and say, it's okay, he's an agent, he's working for us?
Well, indeed. We've come to the end of the show. Of course, next week there'll be a bit of a break due to the Eid celebrations. And,
absolutely, yep.
We should be back as normal the following week. But I'd say thank you to Tony, as always, for enlightening us and, you know, giving us a lot of information.
Thank you very much for inviting me on again.
As always, thank you very much. And thanks to Saeed, to Humayun, to the whole team. We've got about 20 seconds left, so...
We have, like I say, next week is no show, so enjoy your Eid celebration.
Throughout the night, there'll be various recitation, nasheeds, and shows for you to listen to, so do keep listening.
Also, the radio is up and coming next. So
yes.
Thanks so much, guys. I wish you a very good and happy Eid, and see you in 2 weeks' time.
See you in two weeks' time. Thank you very much.
That's Tony Gosling. We're off. Enjoy the Eid celebrations. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on 93.5 Unity FM. We're back in 2 weeks. If you got it once, give him a hug, give him a kiss, tell him you love him. Good evening, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
1-volume English translation with additional appendices includes a short biography of the Prophet, Surah introductions, scientific miracles of the Quran, Old and New Testament prophecies of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, a short guide to wudu and salah, and much more, provided free for all non-Muslims. The Quran Project needs your help and support for this Dawah project. To donate, go to www.quranproject.org. The Quran Project. Be inspired today.
Are you self-employed? Do you have your own business? Are you looking for a professional firm to deal with your accounts and taxation affairs? Then look no further. With over 20 years' experience in the accountancy profession, Shabir Nawab & Co. are ready to help. At Shabir Nawab & Co., we offer a full range of accountancy services tailored to your specific needs. So whether you're starting up in business or are under tax inquiry, give us a call for a free consultation. Call 01217...